It's half past 8.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike sets up a board of almost infallible experts and challenges you to trip them up. You furnish the questions and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in war stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 war bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information, Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and unrehearsed as ever, Information Please offers tonight as its four experts, our three veterans, the old Kieran Levant Adams combination, and as its guest, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., now a major in the United States Army Tank Corps and just returned to this country from Egypt. Now we're going to begin with a question from Paul Caterman of Chicago. This is about famous sailors, gentlemen. We have to get three parts out of four if we can. Here's the first part. Name the sailor who took time out from Harvard to go sailing. Took time out from Harvard. Mr. Kieran.
Mr. Dana, 2 years before the mast.
Yes, that's quite right. His first two names being?
Richard Henry.
All right.
Richard Henry, yes. You're an old Harvard man, aren't you, Major?
I am.
But you don't remember your famous predecessor?
I don't remember having seen him, no.
No, I'm sure you wouldn't. Senator Richard Henry Lodge, Dana.
Senator Lodge is an Army man, anyway.
Well, you don't have to draw the line so close on this program. We're all friendly here. Now, how about a sailor who unintentionally took an undersea voyage? Oh, this might be a someone of legend. Mr. Adams?
I think that was Captain Nemo.
Well, in the
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
I don't think it was unintentional. Didn't he have that little submarine built for him?
I guess
this is a kind of Mr. Kieran?
Jonah.
Yes, I should think Jonah would be a good answer.
McGinty.
McGinty would be a very good one, sure. McGinty or Jonah. Or Geppetto in the movie about Pinocchio.
Pinocchio.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be right, Mr. Levant?
Yes, Siegfried used to go underseas and have his fortune told once in a while with the three. No, he was on land, that's right. They would swim up to him.
Yes, it's better that way. Name the sailor who landed once every 7 years. Got that, Mr. Levant?
The Flying Dutchman.
Flying Dutchman. That's the legend of the Flying Dutchman. Very good. And name the sailor who's jailed for carrying letters for an exile to his followers. Got that, Mr. Levant?
I'm sure I'm wrong. Monte Cristo?
No, you're right. I don't see why you should be so sure you're wrong.
One letter.
Pardon? Well,
one letter.
A letter. Yeah. Is that what got you off, Mr. Kieran?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Edmund Dantes. How about this?
Makes me feel funny being right the way he talked.
You look funny.
Helen Jean Hultman of Dayton, Ohio, sends this one in. Well, this will send our memories traveling back a bit. Who was president when the following things happened? All these things happened during a single presidency. An income tax was levied. Benny Leonard won the lightweight championship from Freddie Welch on a technical KO. Booth Tarkington created Penrod. And more was seen of women's legs, it says here. Mr. Yes, Major.
Wilson.
Yes, Woodrow Wilson. All those things happened during Wilson's administration. Now, here's another. The first subway opened in New York City. The Tinker to Evers to Chance combination helped win three successive pennants. Maud Adams was packing them in with Peter Pan, and everybody was dancing to the Merry Widow Waltz. Mr. Adams.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt is right. Mr. Levant had his hand up, too, and was going to say, Mr. Levant.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Absolutely. How about this one?
It was a happy period. I was about 2 years old.
Okay, have you got a picture of yourself, Mr.
No.
Levant? No? Here's another. The Boston Post exposed get-rich-quick Ponzi. Red Grange was playing football at college. The World War I peace treaty was signed. The crossword puzzle book, first one, was published. And Al Jolson was on his knees singing Mammy. How about that?
Harding.
Pardon?
President Harding.
Yes, and during also
Coolidge.
Yes, Harding and Coolidge, a single 4 years. That's quite right. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. How about this one from Charles C. Smith of Portchester, New York? Here's a simple musical question. Now, you're going to hear 3 songs played. What places that are not mentioned in the titles are named in these songs? In other words, each of these songs has a place name as a title, but there are other places mentioned in each of the songs. What are they? Ready, Mr. Kahn? Let's have the first. Yes, Major Lodge.
Leicester Square.
Leicester Square, yes.
Piccadilly.
Piccadilly and Leicester Square are the 2 other places mentioned. Very good. Mr. Kahn, how about the next one? Mr. Levant?
It's too fast. I sing it slow. In old Manhattan, where silks are... in old Manhattan, Bronx and Staten Island, too.
Very good. That gives us Bronx and Staten Island, too. You sing it slower?
Well, I don't articulate very well.
Not as well as Mr. Kahn does.
Rodgers and Hart in the first Garrigetti.
And yes, and a very good one, too. And there's another place mentioned. It's very funny on old Delancey Street, you know. Isn't that one of the verses?
Yeah.
The subway charms us so. How about this one, Mr. Kahn? Another place mentioned in that song, Mr. Kieran.
Herald Square.
Herald Square. What's the song?
Give my regards to Broadway.
Remember me to Herald Square. How does it go on?
Tell all the boys at 42nd Street that...
And I will soon be there.
Does that scare you, Senator?
Oh, it's all right. It's all right.
You have to be prepared for anything. I suppose it was easier out there in Libya.
Well, they make more noise than that in Congress.
Mr. Adams, who wrote the song?
George M. Cohen.
George M. Cohen. That's quite right.
Words and music.
Words and music. All right, how about this one from Robert J. Greenstein of Louisville, Kentucky? Here's a military question. Under what circumstances on the battlefront is each of these methods of communication used? Let's see if we can get 2 out of 3. Now, the first method is called walkie-talkie. Walkie-talkie, Senator Lodge.
That's infantry man-carried radio set that is used with ground troops.
Yes.
Foot troops.
Might be used by paratroopers, too, could it not be?
It could be paratroopers and could be used by horse troops.
Yes, any advance elements, I suppose, which aren't in direct contact with each other.
That's right.
And the radio, of course, works two ways, two-way That's radio right. communication. That's exactly right. How about blasts on a whistle, and that doesn't mean the kind you'd be apt to hear in the Navy. In other words, not on a boat. Mr. Kieran.
Well, I did use it for infantry commands.
Meaning? Can you give us some, Mr. Kieran, see if you can remember any of them.
I beg your pardon?
See if you can remember any of them.
No. That's too long. I mean, how many whistles for this and that?
That's it.
No, that's too long ago.
Major, can you help us out?
No, we don't use those in the armored force, but I know they're used in the infantry within the company.
Well, short, Mr. Levant?
Well, the motorcycle cop says pull over there with a blast of
Yes, that's what most of us would have heard. Well, a short blast on a whistle means attention to an order, and a long blast means cease firing. And 3 blasts would mean air or tank warning. Would that be right, Major? Do you remember that in your experience on the
Those are the blasts that are given on the horn in an armored unit.
Yes.
For a ground attack or an air attack, they have a great big electric horn that they use instead of a whistle, so you can hear it much further.
I get it. How about kicking as a method of communication? Mr. Kieran.
That is the direction, the way that you direct a tank chauffeur to turn his tank.
Well, now, can you explain that?
Well, because he can't see the driver of the tank. I should explain this with the...
Well, that's what I was beginning to wonder.
The tank expert alongside me, but I know how it works. The tank driver can't see. He's like flying blind, only he isn't flying. And the observer has his head in the clear up above, and he has his feet on the shoulders of the driver of the tank, and they have signal kicks.
Now, Major Lodge, how about that?
Within a light tank, that is true. You tap the driver on the right shoulder to go to the right and on the left shoulder to go to the left, and in the middle to go between the shoulders to go faster. In a medium tank, it's too big, and you have an interphone. The man in the turret has a voice telephone with which he communicates with the driver.
And in the heaviest of tanks, is the same thing true?
The heaviest of tanks, the same would be true.
Telephone communication.
Interphone, yes.
But that's pretty good for Mr. Kieran, who, after all, has probably never been in a tank.
Well, he's always pretty good. He's always very good.
I was caught in a draft with Bob Hope, the whole sequence.
Yeah, that's how you remember, and I knew there was some reason. Gives us 3 out of 3. This is a very good squad here this evening. How about this one from Leonie Perdue of Jonesboro, Georgia? Now, each of these quotations are going to be very short. Each of them is about something. What are these somethings? Here's the first something.
something borrowed. Something borrowed? Mr. Levant?
That's when you get married. Something borrowed, something old, something...
new, something blue.
Blue.
That's right. You want to put a little
borrowed,
more expression...
something blue.
Yes, that's right. Into your voice, Mr. Levant, when you say that. It's an old wedding rhyme. Now, how about something attempted? Something attempted, Mr. Adams?
Something done has earned a night's repose.
Perfect. And what's the quotation from?
Village blacksmith.
Yes, by whom?
H. Wadsworth Longfellow.
Very good. H standing for what, Mr. Adams?
Henry.
Henry.
That's
Henry.
Very good. All right. Now, here's the hardest one. Something, nothing. Gee whiz. Senator?
Well, that's Shakespeare.
That's right.
Who steals
who
my
steals
purse,
my purse steals trash. Tis something nothing.
Tis something
he
nothing.
Who filches my good
whose
name.
Whose mind tis his and has been slave to thousands.
Yeah, I left that out. But he who filches my good name, isn't that right?
That's right.
Is a palooka.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. That gives us a perfect response on that question. Now, Mr. Cross wonders if cigarette smokers sometimes feel like the man who couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, with many different brands of cigarettes to choose from, it may be hard to remember that the same fundamental fact applies to them all. In a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. Yes, better tobacco means a better smoke. That's true whether you're looking for more mildness or finer taste. So smokers, clearly, when you buy cigarettes, it's fine tobacco you want. And Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. At market after market, year after year, we consistently pay whatever it costs to get the better quality leaf. For example, in Greenville, Tennessee, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the American Tobacco Company paid 26% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 26% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. Mr. Fadiman, have I demonstrated that Luckies give smokers what counts? Fine tobacco?
Mr. Cross, you've made the facts crystal clear and in just 59 seconds. Now, how about this one from Ruth Ann Brady of Nashua, Iowa? Here's a rather more difficult musical question. From what musical composition is each of these octave passages taken? There are going to be three of them. We have to get two out of three. Shall we have the first, Mr. Cohn? Certainly sounds easy to compose. Mr. Levant?
I would answer it with a flute. I don't know.
I knew you wouldn't know this one. I was positive.
Probably
you wouldn't know
Birdie,
this one.
That's what.
What were we going to say, Mr. Kieran?
Birdie?
No.
No.
He never could stretch
no.
it.
No. No. Any idea, Senator?
What else, Salou, the best thing?
I'd draw a blank on that.
It's a tough one. It was, this, by the way, was written by somebody named Badarzewska. Does that make it easier?
Was that the Maiden's Prayer?
Yes, that's
right. I never heard it, but I've often wondered about it.
Come back to you now, Mr. Levant. That's the Maiden's Prayer.
Is that right? I've read so much about it. I really have.
Well, beginners at the piano have to learn it.
Well, that was a pièce de résistance for Gottschalk, a fiery pianist in America in the middle 18th.
Just offer of résistance to you, too, Mr. Levant. Well, that gives us one wrong. Now the next one. Next one is on a higher musical level, Mr. Levant. Maybe you'll get it. I knew he would, Mr. Levant.
Funny place to pick, and that's the Revolutionary Etude of
sure
Chopin.
That's very good.
Yeah. How do you like my French, Chopin?
I think that's very good. Say it again.
Chopin.
How would you say it if it were Polish?
Chopin.
Very good. Very good. Famous Revolutionary Etude. And now the third and last. I've got... is that your hand up, Mr. Kieran?
Well...
I think Mr. Kieran ought to know that one.
How about it, Mr. Kieran?
Well, that's Rachmaninoff,
that's
isn't
right.
it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yes, don't look at me as if I should know.
Well, I mean, I'm astonished. Why do you put such easy ones on when I can get them?
That's so. Getting cocky, Mr. Kieran. Yes, that's the famous C minor.
First time I ever saw anybody angry because he answered the question.
That gives us two out of three. Now, how about this one from Mrs. Tony O. Babb of Los Angeles, California? Again, get two out of three. Here's one we all ought to know. Where's each of these United States commanders stationed? The first is Major General Simon Bolivar Buckner, Jr. Where's his post? Major General Buckner, any ideas?
We haven't heard from him lately.
He used to be commandant at West Point.
Not now, though.
Not now,
Major.
No.
Major. Well, we haven't heard as much, perhaps, as we should like to from Major Buckner. Major General Buckner, he's the Alaskan Defense Commander. Way up, helping to defend the Aleutians. How about Major General Russell P. Hartle?
He commands. Major? He commands the infantry troops in Northern Ireland.
Yes, that's quite right. And Lieutenant General Frank M. Andrews, a very important post.
He has the Caribbean Theater.
Yes, the Caribbean Defense Command, Mr. Levant.
Well, he did that Honduras spy thing recently. It was under.
Yes,
that's in his theater.
Under his jurisdiction. That's quite right. How about this one from Miss Janie S. Brown of Jonesboro, Georgia? I'm going to give you some quotations about liberty, about which we think a good deal these days, and all these quotations come from songs that we should know. Tell me what ones they are. Where does liberty's form stand in view? Mr. Adams.
In Columbia, the gem of the ocean.
Yes. Oh, for thy mandates make heroes assemble when liberty's form stands in view. It's in the first stanza.
Thy banners make tyranny tremble.
That's the one.
Three cheers for the red, white, and blue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good. All right. Now, where is there an author of liberty? Quote, an author of liberty, close quote. Yes, Major.
Our Father's God to thee, author of liberty.
That's the one, yes. It's from
the hymn.
America, of course. And where are we found rallying round our liberty? Rallying round our liberty. That's perhaps the toughest of the three. No?
No.
Any ideas? How about a guess? Mr. Kieran, care to guess?
No, rally round the flag's the only one.
Yes, but that's not the one. Firm united let us be, rallying round our liberty as a band of brothers joined, peace and
safety. Hail Columbia.
That's the one. Hail Columbia, happy land. Well, that gives us two out of three. How about this one from David Tinberg of Pittsburgh? What are these measurements descriptions of? Now, the first set of measurements is this. Length, 300 cubits. Breadth, 50 cubits. Height, 30 cubits. What's being measured, Mr. Adams?
The ark.
Yeah. Yes, the well-known ark belonging to whom, Mr. Adams?
Noah.
Well, it belonged really to Noah. I suppose he was the skipper.
I suppose he was, yes. Captain
Noah. He was the lessee.
Sure.
And the cook and Captain Bold.
Now, how about this one? 59 inches around superstructure, 57 inches around midships, 32 inches from center of gravity to keel, weight, 386 pounds.
Weight, 386 pounds.
That could be a very personal question.
Whom are you referring to, Mr. Levan?
I won't refer to it. I have a feeling. No, I better not.
Any ideas?
Does this structure sing?
No, I don't think this structure... I don't think it's a singing structure.
Is that...
it wouldn't be an ocean mine, would it?
No. No, I guess not. I guess you must have missed this little item in the papers, gentlemen. There was a shipyard worker at San Pedro named M.R. Wolfe.
Oh, yeah, he wanted the overalls.
Oh, yeah, that's the fellow. Now it all comes back to you, doesn't it? He had some difficulty in getting clothes to fit him, remember? Mm-hmm. He said he's 59 inches around the superstructure. Mm-hmm. That means the chest, Mr. Levant. 57 inches midships and 32 inches from the center of gravity to his keel and weight 386 pounds. And I think the president got him fixed up with a suit of working clothes.
Give him a special priority.
I have no doubt. That sends...
Tent and awning company.
Made by Omar the tent maker. Here's another one. Weight 27 tons. Mount 75-millimeter gun and 37-millimeter gun. Four machine guns and a Tommy gun. I think I'll let the musician out of this, have the senator answer.
That's the M3 medium tank.
Yes.
So-called General Grant.
General Grant. Yeah. Senator, are all the tanks named after generals?
Well, we number them, and then when they get into the British Army, they put names on them, because it's easier to remember the names than it is to use the numbers. Our light tank they call a Honey, because the first one that got to Egypt, they asked the American soldier who was with it whether it was a good tank, and he said, boy, it's a Honey. So now they call them the Honey.
That's very picturesque. But it seems to be true that a good many of the tanks are named after famous American generals. There's the General Lee, isn't there?
The Lee is the M4. That's the new one with the gun in the middle. Mm-hmm. And the light tank is officially named the Stuart. The very heavy one is going to be called the Sherman, I think.
After General Sherman.
Probably the sweetheart in time, I hope.
All right, how about this one? from Amy Winslow of Cleveland, Ohio. Who is the man who at various times in his career was the successor to the job of each of these men? Now, in the first case, he was the successor to his father, to Arthur M. Hyde, and to John Garner. Who was that man, Mr. Levant?
Wallace.
Henry Wallace, yes. Who his father was?
Secretary of Agriculture.
Well, he succeeded his father as editor of Wallace's Farm.
Yeah, but his father also was Secretary of Agriculture.
Yes, and how about John Garner?
Vice President.
Vice President, of course. Now. Arthur M. Hyde, Secretary of Agriculture. How about this one? Successor to Colonel Theodore Roosevelt, to Homer Cummings, and to Justice Butler. Who is that? He was the successor to all of those three men. Shall I read them again? Colonel Theodore Roosevelt, Homer Cummings, Justice Butler.
Well, that would make him a Supreme Court judge.
Well, go ahead. I'm not going to give you the answer.
That's pretty good for
Mr.
me.
Mr. Kieran?
Philippines.
Hughes. Charles Evans Hughes.
I don't think it would work out.
Was he governor of New York?
Yes.
And he was...
But he wasn't attorney general.
I don't think he was ever attorney general. Was he,
Jackson?
Senator?
No.
No. Mr. Adams, you were on the right track.
Governor General of the Philippines.
Yeah, well, who is this fellow?
Murphy.
Murphy, yes.
Frank Murphy. Yeah.
Frank Murphy, yes.
Colonel Frank Murphy. He's in the Army now.
He's in the Army now. Succeeded Theodore Roosevelt as Governor General of the Philippines. He succeeded
That's
Homer Cummings as Attorney General.
That's a trick.
That's a trick question.
Oh, yes, it is. Well, we have to be a little unfair. We have fellows as bright as you on the program. I think I'll call that wrong. Now we have to get the next one right. He was the successor to Joseph Kennedy, to Roscoe Pound, and to Fiorello LaGuardia.
Adams.
James M. Landis.
James M. Landis, yes. Succeeded Mr. Kennedy as chairman of the SEC, Roscoe Pound as dean of Harvard Law School, and Mr. LaGuardia as director of the OCD. Now, before we go on to the next question, Mr. Cross has some questions for you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you're smoking a cigarette now or have one handy, I wish you'd take a brief look at it, at that slender tube of white paper containing tobacco. And let me just ask you this. Was tobacco for your cigarette bought at the auctions down south? The answer is yes, of course. And were independent tobacco experts present at those auctions? Yes, again, at every one of them. Independent experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehousemen saw just who bought what tobacco. At auctions all over the South, year after year, they see the makers of Lucky's consistently pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. And so, with these independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-1. Smokers, isn't that something worth acting on? Remember, tobacco experts know that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. That took just 57 seconds. Now, how about this one from Eileen Wynn of Atlanta, Georgia? Can you recite for us lines of poetry from different poems that mention three different articles of military ordnance or ammunition? Well, that takes in a lot of territory. Mr. Kieran, start us off.
Cannons to right of them, cannons to left of them, volleyed and thundered.
Very good. I think it's cannon instead of cannons, you know?
Well, either way.
Mr. Levant.
Johnny, get a gun.
Perfectly okay. And Mr. Adams?
Shoot if you must, this old gray head.
Yes, but that's not a head is not a part of not an ammunition.
No, but what the shot was might have been carried with was.
Oh, yes, but don't you think you're quibbling a bit?
I'm quibbling.
Yes, I think so. Mr. Kieran?
The pen is mightier than the sword.
Yes, that's a very good one. Mr. Levant?
It's always that way with passion, so cowboy, learn to behave, or else you're liable to cash in with no tombstone on your grave. There isn't anything in there at all.
Well, you might have hit it if you'd continued
long enough. I knew he was going to die. I forgot it.
Forgot there's no ammunition
there's
involved.
No implement.
No implement. Mr. Adams.
Is this a dagger that I see before me?
Yes, beautifully done, Mr. Adams. Sure. There's one from Gunga Din, Mr. Kieran, that I know you know about a bullet. What did the bullet
when
do?
The bullet came and drilled the beggar clean.
That's the one, sure. And from our own...
And I drew my snicker snee.
Say, that's a good one. I don't know what a snicker snee is, but it sounds like
it's
a weapon.
It's a dagger also.
Japanese dagger.
Japanese dagger. They call it snicker snee in Japanese, do they, Senator?
Yes, or a snee.
How about the bombs bursting in air?
Yes, I was going to say, from our own national anthem, surely. Well, there we are with five or six of them. How about this from Mrs. M.D. Hicks of Trenton, New Jersey? I might remind you, gentlemen, that so far we have not paid out any $50 war bonds, which is kind of tough on the government. Here's one. Describe what happens when an army uses these tactics in battle. And I have here three technical words. The first is infiltration, the second is envelopment, and the third is encirclement. Major Lodge.
Well, infiltration is the presence of small numbers of men, usually on foot, who get in behind the enemy lines under cover of darkness and do as much damage as they can to rear installations, and if they are successful, establish an organized center of resistance.
Yes. Can you give any classic examples in this war of infiltration tactics?
Oh, there are any number of them. I think the Japanese attack on Java was a
might
good example
a good
of those
one,
tactics.
Yes. Malaya, Bataan.
Yes, all that.
Now, how about envelopment? Major Lodge?
Well, envelopment is an organized effort by large units using all weapons, all arms, to come around the enemy's flank and envelop his flank, surround his
flank. Yes, both flanks.
That's a double envelopment.
Well, that can be, of course, single envelopment.
Yes.
How, I suppose, the invasion of France would be a good example of envelopment tactics.
Well, there were any number of envelopments there, and, of course, in the recent battle in North Africa, there was a single envelopment coming around the south flank of the British minefield.
Yes, and how about encirclement? Senator, do you want to take this away, too? How about encirclement?
Well, encirclement is what General Rommel did in North Africa in the second phase when he came all the way around the south flank and then pointed north. And,
well, you completely surround
and
the...
And changed the axis of the movement from east to west to north and south.
Yes, well, it's a matter of completely surrounding the body of men that you're after.
Yes, and so if you think you're safe fairly far back on an east and west fight, you find yourself way out
the
front when the axis shifts north and south, and that's just what happened to me once.
Oh, we're glad to have you here with us. Here's one from Mr. W.H. Landgrebe of Wellington, Ohio. Now, here are some books written by well-known people who are not thought of primarily as writers. Who are the authors of them? The first is The Breadwinners. Mr. Adams.
I think that was written by Judge Robert Grant.
No, I don't think it was.
No, by John Hay.
Yes. What made you say Grant instead of Hay, I wonder? Interesting slip of the mind.
Robert Grant was a judge who also wrote fiction.
Yes, but it's a far-fetched connection.
A Boston judge.
I'm going to call that right. John Hay, who was Secretary of State, was he not? In whose
administration? President Lincoln.
No, he was Lincoln's secretary.
He was Lincoln's personal secretary, yes. And later on, was he not
around
Secretary of State?
Around 1890-something.
Secretary of State.
Hay-Pawnsforth Treaty.
Under McKinley.
Under McKinley, I think it was. And his novel, The Breadwinners, was published in 84. Friends of Mr. Sweeney. Who wrote Friends of Mr. Sweeney? Mr. Kieran.
Elmer Davis,
yes. Our director of the Office of War Information. And a very good novel, too. Life of Alexander Hamilton. Life of Alexander Hamilton, written by someone not generally thought of as an author.
Not primarily
thought of as an author. Any ideas?
You'd have said Beethoven, I would have known.
I'm sorry, I can't work it for you. Senator? Well, Senator
my grandfather wrote one.
Yes, that's the one I was thinking of. Henry Cavendish. Thank you very much.
That's the one I read for the American Statesman series.
That's right, American Statesman series.
I'm afraid that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Major Lodge, for joining in the fun this evening. Now, in a few seconds, I'll announce next week's guests. Tonight we have a perfect score. We've paid out no sets of the Britannica and no $50 war bonds.
Fine
set of patriots you are. And we're glad to report, by the way, that the 10% club's membership is increasing by leaps and bonds. To join this club, you know, you agree to use 10% of your income toward the purchase of the best and safest investment you can make. War bonds and stamps to keep yourself and your family free. If you're not already a member of the 10% club, join now. Now, next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will do their stuff, and our guests will be first the author and sports expert, Mr. Paul Gallico, and second, the eminent attorney and currently the successful author of City Lawyer, Mr. Arthur Garfield Hayes. Remember, those who are listening, to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to information, please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, right in New York City. And now we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs.